beloved. Welcome back to another episode of the Rename Beloved podcast. I'm Meridia.
And I'm Maggie.
And today we are continuing on in our series in the crucifixion of the King of Glory. Today we are starting part two, which is the trial. It starts at the Last Supper, this section, and then it continues all the way to finish his trial. It covers both the Roman and the Jewish trials that Jesus endured the night going into his crucifixion and the morning of, because these things continued. This section of the book, it begins on a very personal note. I think it forces us to consider Jesus as a person, and the intricacies of a personal mind, and forces us to kind of consider what it must have been like to be a betrayed Christ by someone you're with every day. Yeah. What is it, you know, like to make ourselves a willing sacrifice? So what stood out to you in the second section?
So much. Like you said, this section, you know, the king on trial, it starts with the betrayal of Christ by Judas. We did talk a little bit about Judas in our last book club series. So
yeah.
I don't want to say too much about that, but I do want to just speak to the willingness of Christ to allow all of this to happen. This author is very adamant in her writing, and I think it's very appropriate, in my opinion, that she really emphasizes that Christ, like, none of this happened to Christ without his full consent. He willingly submitted himself into the hands of the Father. So that's an aspect of Judas that we didn't touch on as much in our last book club, but it's so important to consider that he allowed the events to proceed, which would lead to his crucifixion. Something that, and then it kind of goes into the story about, it's called, the chapter is called The Agony in the Garden, about how Jesus is really teaching us how to pray in that moment. It's like fully knowing that it will bring suffering, knowing that he asks the cup to be passed from him, but if it can't, he asks that the Father's will be done. And so, like you said, it really emphasizes the humanity, the agony, the anxiety that, yes, Jesus was God fully, but he was human. So for me, it's that it emphasizes how much Jesus he has experienced these deeply intense emotions of fear, anguish, pain. I would argue far above and beyond any that we could experience as humans, like in what we are doing and what we're called to do in our lives. But it brings back to me just that we don't serve a high priest who's disconnected from our experience, that he does. He's not asking us to follow him and take up our cross, and he's not asking us to do anything that he hasn't already done for us. So, you know, we've talked a little bit about, but just this book takes one step at a time. It really slows down and invites us to reflect on each and every moment. And I know you probably want to say more about that, but another thing I'll just say quickly is that it highlight this chapter of the, or the section rather, of the book highlighted for me just how, like, how badly you can sense how badly the Jewish leaders were just trying to prove a point with Jesus and make an example of him, because of how they basically virtually pass him back and forth between one authority and the next and the next, and the way she lays out the Jewish trial and then the Roman trial. When you're reading these accounts in the Gospels, it's easy, at least for me, to kind of lump all these events into one, but there's such a distinction that must be made between the events and how it proceeded within the Jewish community and that leadership, and how it actually eventually was carried out with the Roman officials, who ended up being the ones who had the power to crucify. I found it interesting, because we talked a little bit about in part one how the Jewish leadership was kind of sovereign in its own way. Like, it had authority and autonomy in some ways, but it was mostly around the temple and the rituals. So they could technically execute the death penalty, the Jewish people could, but it was for, like, violation of temple proceedings. If somebody entered into a part of the temple that they weren't supposed to be in, they could actually execute them and offer up the death penalty to them. But in any other matter, the Jewish people didn't have the power to actually put somebody to death. Yeah. So you see in this section kind of that dynamic of how bad, like, it's giving desperate to the max, because yes, they're plotting, they're scheming. You can kind of sense the manipulation and the deviousness and the scheming and the striving going on within the Jewish community to, like, make an example out of Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't also want to do it. They didn't want him to be put to death silently or out of the public eye. They wanted,
To humiliate him.
Exactly. They wanted to humiliate him. Mm-hmm. They wanted to prove a point. And it's just, yeah, that's what it comes to mind for me, is just how the distinctions the author made between the Jewish proceedings and the Roman proceedings.
I think that's a very good point, because I think that while the Bible is, like, a long book, I don't think the Gospels really, it's hard to get a picture of all these events are happening over 3 years. I mean, it could, some of the Gospels start at, like, the birth of Christ, like the Gospel of Luke. So these are over 30 years of events condensed into this one book, and so they seem to flow together a lot more in the Gospels, and we're not as familiar with the flow of text and how they used to write back then, so you have to be, like, very careful when you're reading the Gospels, like, phrases and then could dictate, like, much, like, weeks down the line is essentially, like, or but then, like, all of these, like, little phrases in the Gospels denote big jumps of time. You have to really pay attention. Mm-hmm. And I think she does a phenomenal job of highlighting that and accenting it, to kind of do that for you and teach you to do it for yourself later.
Yeah.
How to properly do that. I think interesting, too, you pointed out basically the attachment. We touched on this in the last chapter, but you touched on another aspect of it here, and it brought it together in my mind, that it's almost like Jesus is coming to these people and to really point out the contrast between these people who cannot let go of earthly status and earthly power, like all this stuff here, all this temporal stuff. Like, Jesus was perceived as a threat to the entire structure that the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the Sanhedrin at large, the elders, whatever, had set into place to provide for not extravagance and provide for themselves and their families, mm-hmm. and provide them authority. And Pilate even is, so Jesus is basically exonerated before the Jews as sinless. Mm. He's exonerated before the Gentile world as sinless by, like, the premier empire at the time. He hasn't done anything. Mm-hmm. Herod, the king of the Jews, with that, you know, he has more authority. That's why Pilate sends him off to Herod, not the Sanhedrin takes him to Pilate, and then Pilate sends him to Herod.
So they're just, like, passing him back and forth.
Yeah, they're, like, passing him around because the Sanhedrin actually doesn't have the authority to kill him, but they're the most angry with him, mm-hmm. because he has offended them. He's embarrassed them. Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of the things that Jesus says, like, walking, imagine just the most prominent pastor you know. Imagine someone going up to him and saying, "Verily I say unto you, the prostitutes and the tax collectors are going to get into the kingdom of heaven before you." Mm. Like, the prostitutes and the drug addicts before your favorite pastor. The offense of that, mm-hmm. you know, like, the, like, we can hardly fathom something like that really happening. And that's what Jesus was doing. He was going, he was offending them. He's publicly embarrassing them. By demonstrating power from God they did not have, mm-hmm. like his ability to heal the blind, heal paralytics, give deaf people back their sight. He was demonstrating the power of God, mm-hmm. in a way beyond the prophets and far, far behind the high priest, beyond the high priest. God was clearly with him in a way that he was not with the Sanhedrin and the power that they had. And I think that that's really profound, like, that you see this contrast in people, even the rich young ruler, mm-hmm. right? He's all Jesus is like, "Well, give up your possessions." Mm-hmm. And he goes away very sad. And the Pharisees, the Sadducees, Pilate, they're all like that.
Mm-hmm.
They will not let go of this earthly position for the, you know, kingdom of heaven. And I think that's profound.
Absolutely. And you, yeah, you can sense, I think, and that's why I appreciated her writing on this in the way that she did, because you can just sense they were adamant that they were going to get Jesus, silence him and kill him. Mm-hmm. And it's like, we know that reading the Gospels, but she was able to really bring to life the human interactions and the tension. And for example, and also the hypocrisy, you know, there's a chapter on the Jewish trial, and then there's a chapter on the Roman trial. In the Jewish trial, she points out that they're breaking their own laws about mm-hmm. Jewish trials within their own body in order to convict him on the day before a Sabbath, on the day before a high holiday.
At night. They're not supposed to be holding the trial.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So she gives some context to like what would have been acceptable even within their own laws. And the need for witnesses, for example. Mm-hmm. And obviously we know Christ through most of this accusation was silent. He did speak it in some, you know, key moments mm-hmm. where, you know, but for the most part, he was silent and kind of just allowed these proceedings to take place. And because I think that's so powerful in showing the hypocrisy too, they needed witnesses, for example, but they found none. And so it's like she shows them kind of trying to scrounge up witnesses like first thing in the morning when the sun's still not up, you know, like you can just see how they're the anxiety that mm-hmm. and how it's playing out. So that's something that I hadn't appreciated before, that they're really going out of their way to make sure that Jesus is silent. And then, well, what was I going to say here? And this to me, I don't know, I've just been on this kick of really discerning and like parsing out people. I'm getting bothered, increasingly bothered by people who claim that Jesus was some sort of political revolutionary figure. Mm-hmm. These chapters on how the Roman trial proceeded, we're talking about a Roman Empire who was brutal, as you say, mm-hmm. who was quick to put down any dissent. That's one of the other reasons mm-hmm. that there's this motivation that they don't want Jesus to continue to draw massive crowds during the Passover in Jerusalem, because they know that if there's any unrest, the Roman Empire will crush what's going on. They're not, mm-hmm. keep in mind, they're celebrating the liberation of slavery in Egypt, which I mentioned on the last episode, but there's all this political, it's almost like, this is a horrible example of equivalence, but like how you get feeling patriotic maybe at certain yeah. times of the year, maybe it's like the 4th of July or whatever, like this national fervor and this patriotic type of spirit. And it's not even just nationalism, it's like a religious fervor and zeal that is heightened at this time of year. So the Jews are trying to keep all of that at bay. And simultaneously, you have the Roman Empire who's going to be quick to put down anybody who they deem as trying to start some sort of political revolution. But over and over and over, Pilate doesn't even know who this Jesus is. And Pilate would have, if there was a political revolutionary after 3 years of ministry, he would have, absolutely, they would have been on his radar. Who he was, yeah. Exactly. Same with Herod, who would have been the king in Galilee where Jesus had his ministry. If he was some sort of political revolutionary, they would have known who he was. But still, they're just like, oh, this is your king, you say? And they just continue to mock him. And they just continue to mock him. And it just goes to show the true innocence. Like you meant, I'm glad you pointed that out, because you can see the striving and the clear innocence of Christ, how they're trying to, in the Jewish people, they're trying to create accusation and they're trying to like stir up energy toward crucifying him. And then in the Roman world, he's also declared innocent among both his own people and among the Gentiles. So that's so important. And that's something that we know this. We know that Pilate washes his hands of Jesus's blood, but you can see, I can appreciate so much more after reading this, just how much, like, shedding innocent blood was obviously, nobody wants that, but it was mm-hmm. considered so, it was like the worst thing. Like, there was a huge fear of it, I guess is what I'm trying to say, amongst Jews and Romans. It was just, you don't want to have innocent blood on your hands. So we know Pilate washes his blood of Jesus's death, but this has allowed me to really reflect on just how deeply he was not wanting to be involved. Mm-hmm. He was like, you see to it yourselves then. Like, he went over and over and over trying to exonerate him. And we see that too with Barabbas.
Yeah. It was about more than just killing him. Mm-hmm. They had to discredit him publicly. Like, it was a way of making him seem shamed by God. in a fulfillment ultimately of Isaiah 53, the suffering servant passage. First of all, he goes silent. And when Jesus does speak, the power and the depth of his statements is, you know, just really up there. Like, I'm thinking there is a bit here where Pilate gets mad at Jesus because he's not answering him. Mm-hmm. Pilate's like trying to get him off, essentially, of the charges.
Yeah.
He's certain that they won't release Barabbas because Barabbas is like a known murderer, a known highway thief, a known revolutionary. There's like a lot of problems with Barabbas, as like he's a deeply
like an infamous figure.
Yeah, it would be like letting it'd be like Jeffrey Dahmer and Jesus on trial. Like, here you have this like infamous, like bloody person that like is like known.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we know that this is the guy. Like, there's not doubt on this case, you know what I mean? Pilate's certain that they'll let Jesus go and insist on Barabbas, but that's not what happens. And so he gets mad though. So backing up a little bit to when Jesus is confronting Judas, what's really interesting to me is he comes to meet him, and in the Gospel of Matthew, Matthew records it like this. Jesus said to him, "Friend, why are you here?" Then they came and laid hands on Jesus and seized him. But what's interesting about that is it's very similar to the question that God asked Adam in the Garden of Eve. Where are you? Mm-hmm. Why are you here? He knows.
Mm-hmm.
He already knows. The question is for Judas to locate Judas.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, I was like, oh, it's the I am again. Like asking the same type of question, the same line of questioning, just to like almost bring attention. And it's so merciful of him. Like, Judas, would you betray the Son of Man with a kiss? That's how Luke puts it.
Mm-hmm.
It's this like almost like tenderness. Like, what are you doing and why are you doing it?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of energy that Jesus is giving to Judas, even up until the end. His grace there is immense. And
calling him friend.
Yeah, he calls him friend. And then there's a part here I underlined from her writing that I want to read out loud. Jesus was still trying to amend Judas by this mild statement, teaching us by his example to pity those who seek to do us harm.
Hmm.
There's that powerful example Jesus gives us there. And then going to further as he's praying in the garden, that's for us.
Mm-hmm.
I love that he prays, and I talked about this a little bit last night, but I love that he prays for 3 hours for the peace of God to come on him. He's in agony. His soul is so grieved. And like, it ministered to me because sometimes, like, obviously, like when I go through things, I pray, but I don't pray for 3 hours. Mm-hmm. I don't like stop everything, stay up all night. Who cares?
Mm-hmm.
I need God's peace. But I'm like, that's what I should do. That's what Jesus did. He sought and he sought and he sought for 3 hours until the peace of God came on him. Then he rises and he's like so girded up in the spirit.
Right.
And God has sent an angel to strengthen him.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like ready and he's able to bear all this with silence.
Mm-hmm.
Just what the night before he was sweating blood,
mm-hmm.
you know, but by the next night he's crucified. He's beat. He's ready to deal with all of that silently. So it's like the power of prayer.
Yeah.
Too. Not just the way he prays, which is incredibly profound. I mean, there's just so much.
Yeah.
It's packed.
It is packed. This whole book is so packed.
Thank you all so much for joining us today. We're excited to get into the last part of the crucifixion, which really goes into a different section. We start to see the freeing of Barabbas. We start to see more evidence worldwide for the earthquake, for the veil ripping, for the darkness. She gets into even more apologetic work there, does some very good apologetic work, finding that from pagan sources. So we're super excited to share the next part with you. If you're interested in purchasing this book, we do have a link, an affiliate link in the description. we would love if you would use that link, or if you would just join us in general in any way, shape, or form in reading this book. I think it would bless you.
Yeah.
If you like this kind of content, please subscribe and like to help it get out in the algorithm. And one of the best things you could do to help us would be to share this with someone who you think it would minister to, mm-hmm. and who you think that needs to hear this message. So we love you. We thank you for listening to us today, and pray you have a blessed week.